In one respect, you can just say that film is a modern venue with particular characteristics, just as there are spaces where it's more difficult for the voice to carry in the live theater and others where it's easier for the voice to carry. So you deal with different issues wherever you perform it. And if you happen to be performing it in front of a camera and a microphone, that's just a different venue.
Hi, and welcome to The State of Shakespeare. I'm Jim Elliott.
And I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And today on the program, we have John Osborne. John is an associate director of the Connect program, a theater-based communication training program at the Cooper Union. He has taught at Vassar College and the New School University, and he currently teaches Shakespeare on film at New York University. Welcome, John.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us.
It's an absolute pleasure. How long have you taught the Shakespeare on Film class?
Since 1998.
Well, take us back to 1998. If I remember correctly, maybe some contemporaneous Shakespeare films in 1998 would have been the Kenneth Branagh films.
Yes, they were still very fresh and very recent, most of them.
And the Mel Gibson film wouldn't have been too far in the past.
That's correct. The Hamlet with Zeffirelli.
And the big one was the Romeo and Juliet by Baz Luhrmann, right?
Yes, that was the one that at that time all of the students would have seen.
Oh, that's right, with Claire Danes and Leonardo DiCaprio, right?
That's right. And it's interesting. Now, I think in general, there was more Shakespeare film going on the part of the students in 98 than there is now. I don't know why that is. Because the people who used to sign up for the class, the students, and these are undergraduate NYU students, in the theater department mostly.
Self-selecting.
Yeah, they would be self-selecting, although for different reasons. Some self-select because of a very strong interest in Shakespeare, and others self-select because they have a hard time with Shakespeare, and they have the notion that, well, maybe if we look at him in the movies, I'll have an easier time connecting, understanding the language, and so on.
Do you think that's true?
In the classroom, it's sort of true because you can look at a performance, whereas if it's just, say, an English class where you're just looking at the texts, mostly, of course, you can always show clips or whatever, or act out scenes, or go to a production that's up and running. But looking at Shakespeare on film at least gives you some sort of realized version of the text to go along with the reading of the text. And that is helpful for some students.
Are there particular films, John, that you use to talk about the text?
I try to do a sort of vaguely historical order in which you give them some idea of the history of Shakespeare on film. I always include the Olivier Henry V.
When you introduce Shakespeare to the students, do you begin with the films themselves or do you start with the text?
It's interesting. I teach, this class is a class that is offered in the summer sessions. And because it's a summer session, my first screening comes before they will have had the opportunity to have been assigned a text. And then throughout the semester, we will then talk about and look at the text before seeing the film of the text.
I want to touch on the Olivier Henry V for just a minute since you referenced it. So if you've been teaching this class since 1998 and have taught it every summer since 1998, it's plausible that you've seen this film, what, 15, 20, 25, how many times?
I think that's probably right. And I've sometimes taught the class twice in a summer.
Well, a question germane to this topic is whether the Olivier film holds up after all this time. A secondary question would be whether the Olivier film holds up to repeated viewings.
Well, you know, that is interesting. And it's not the only film I've seen over and over again. One thing that happens if you see it multiple times for reasons other than wanting to see it again, it's impossible to be bored by it anymore. The first time I saw the Olivier Henry V, I was terribly disappointed in it at the time. I have to say, it didn't grip me.
Why not?
I found it hard to listen to and hard to follow in text terms. But it wasn't that I didn't understand it. It's that there was something flat about it. And so I left it. And then I was invited to teach this class. I went, well, I've got to look at that film because it is, in retrospect, the film in which a artist of genuine distinction decided to really try to grapple with the tricky issue of putting a work that was written for one medium into terms consistent with another medium, one that didn't even exist when the play was, of course, written. And so in the history of Shakespeare on film, it's terribly important and quite ingenious, and I have a lot of respect for it now, and like it a lot better.
So flash forward, and you subject your students to the same disheartening experience that you endured as a student.
That is true. I do subject them to that. But of course, I'm contextualizing it as historically important. It really is a very ingenious exercise in trying to pull those two media, three media together. And basically was trying to make the statement, I think, this can indeed be done in a way that is credible. Because, you know, to this day, there are people who think, these were written for the stage. They don't really belong on film. Sure, there's good stuff, and it's great that people are seeing the plays, but in the end, it's only about the theater.
It seems to me that the fact that Henry V was committed to film renders the opening speech, the famous chorus, "O for a Muse of Fire," profoundly ironic, considering that Shakespeare certainly never dreamed that his words could have been translated into such a medium, one that would transcend the wooden O in such a profound way.
Yeah, well, yes, I agree about the irony of it, but in some ways that is what makes it a play that, at least fortuitously, was a very good one for Olivier to begin this experiment of making the translation to film, because essentially what the Muse of Fire speech does is outline the problematic of the theater, that we can't take you there directly. You have to imagine it, and we have to help you imagine it through words. And film offers a potential sort of, I don't know, surrogate process, maybe you could say, for amending that difficulty. It's like, okay, we can now help you out a bit with that imaginative process. So that speech actually opens up the kind of prospect of this kind of aesthetic exploration that I think the Henry V is very innovative in using. And what that means is also there's a kind of expectation of at least a somewhat naturalistic acting style in conventional, you know, Hollywood or popular filmmaking. You want the acting to be believable and so on. And there's a kind of inherent stylization in Shakespeare. And what Olivier does by setting it in the theater and then moving it into film is he justifies everything about it that has to remain theatrical for it to work and be true to the text. By having it be the part of this imaginative kind of Muse of Fire process, he's able to retain a kind of elevated style both to the decor and the costumings and the delivery that it would be harder to do in a way that an audience might accept if it just plunged right into a realistic, sort of cinematically realistic setting.
I think that the Bernard version of Henry V, and I think it's worth talking about that version as well, starts in the same vein. I mean, it's Derek Jacobi on a stage, if I'm not mistaken.
A soundstage.
But I believe as he moves through it, we enter the world of Henry V.
Yes, there's a very dramatic opening of the door, and then you're in a convincing, cinematically real time period and so on.
Do you think that Bernard choosing Henry V as his first Shakespeare film chose it with a nod to Olivier?
I have no doubt whatsoever about it.
I think it ushered in a massive explosion of Shakespeare on film.
Yes, it did. He I think, deserves a lot of credit for sort of revitalizing it. Bernard and also the Lurman Romeo and Juliet were huge shots in the arm in the 90s for Shakespeare on film.
What are some of the more memorable film adaptations? Obviously, Olivier's Henry V, but as we move forward in time, what ones stand out over the last 50 years to you?
I'm very fond of the Orson Welles oeuvre of Shakespeare, which includes, of course, a Macbeth, which is not the best, an Othello, which is very, very interesting, and his Chimes at Midnight, which is a compilation into story form of the Falstaff scenes, which basically takes the Henry IV and Henry V and tosses in a bit of Merry Wives, and there's a little bit of Richard II in it as well as bits and pieces from Holinshed's Chronicles of English History to use his narration, and sort of remake Shakespeare as the either the tragedy of or the comedy or the, of Falstaff. Of course, Zeffirelli did a number of films. The Romeo and Juliet was a fairly big deal, kind of pop culture phenomenon, rather similar to Luhrmann's back in the 60s.
And what about the current Much Ado?
The Joss Whedon Much Ado. It's an interesting piece of work, one which has been criticized by some, but which I enjoyed very much. One thing that happens, because film is a modern media, it immediately sets up a kind of tension with any kind of period material. The late Stanley Kaufman, the film and drama critic, once pointed out that when you see a historical film, there's an underlying contradiction to it, because the conceit of film is that there's this thing going on and someone is basically filming it without the knowledge of the people who are in the drama. But of course, there were no cameras way back when, so there's this automatic kind of tension in any period film. But of course, by putting Shakespeare in modern dress, it's in a sense no longer a period film, but what is being spoken about is still period, right? So when they're talking about Italy and California, what are they really talking about? When they're talking about being back from the wars, but they seem to be, oh, dressed like businessmen or film producers or whatever. What do they mean by the wars? Is it?
Don't be talking to the agents.
Is it talking to the agents? And he doesn't answer any of those questions. And then people say things that today would be totally inappropriate, like Claudio saying, oh, I'd marry her even were she an Ethiop. Which in Shakespeare's day was just something someone would have said, but now it's racist. And so Whedon, of course, has this black woman who's a guest and shows us her facial expression when that is said. And so you have this kind of juxtaposition of something that would have been simply kind of an ordinary, uninterrogated prejudice in Shakespeare's time and highlights it with a modern attitude. It's only one moment in it, but I thought it was quite brilliant. And even Beatrice's whole speech about, oh, were I a man,
right,
delivered by a contemporary woman in a contemporary setting, has a very peculiar kind of power that the juxtaposition of the two periods allows for. Now, you could do that in the theater as well.
That brings up my next question, which is very contextual. Right now, it seems that we're in the midst of a golden age of Shakespeare on the stage. And I think that that may be partly due to the fact that Shakespeare seems to epitomize what is best about the theater experience and what theater does better, quite frankly, than film, or what theater is able to do that film simply isn't. And theater creates an event, and there is a sense that we're all here in one place sharing this thing that is happening at this time. So Shakespeare as material is perfectly suited to what theater does best. Now, what does film do with Shakespeare that theater can't? Why is Shakespeare suited to film in ways that other material may or may not be?
Well, there are things that conceivably could be done in the theater and probably have been done, which can be done more readily on film. So maybe it's not that the film does it and the theater can't do it, but there are some things that film can do more readily. A couple of examples. Trevor Nunn made a film of Twelfth Night. One of the interesting things he did in that film was he could intercut scenes that, in terms of the logic of the plot, might have been happening simultaneously, but of course in the way the script is organized, have to be organized successively in some way or another. So he got some very, very interesting rhythms going by intercutting scenes which, as far as their chronological logic went, might have been happening simultaneously. So he could do things that are rhythmically sort of different. Soliloquies, of course, are made to be spoken directly to the audience by the person speaking them. So how do you do that on film? Well, one common thing to do is to do a kind of voiceover. So you're hearing what is being thought kind of as an internal monologue inside the character's head.
As they engage in other visually stimulating activities.
Yes. Now, I don't necessarily like that by and large, but occasionally it can be done in a way that makes you realize something about the play or the character or the soliloquy itself. Gregor Kuznetsov's film of Hamlet, with the actor Smoktunovsky in the lead role, takes the rogue and peasant slave soliloquy and allows it to simultaneously unfold in voiceover in Hamlet's mind as he is watching the player king deliver the Hecuba speech. Then, of course, all of a sudden he breaks out at some point with one of the exclamatory statements, and everyone turns and looks at him. The player king's speech stops. And what that, I think, reveals about that speech, it's a very unusual soliloquy. It's retrospective. It takes us through a process that Hamlet has already been through while he's watching the player king deliver that speech, during which he realizes this man has more passion and will to action than I do, and what can I do to make the final decision? I'll put a play before the king. And it's very clear when you look at it that Hamlet, in that speech, in the play, is taking you through the process he went through while watching player king give his speech. We know he's already decided to do the play within the play because he's given the players instructions and sent them off.
I like your answer, John Osborne, so much. I think the topic of what film can do for Shakespeare that the theater can't is very exciting.
Absolutely.
So those are just a couple of examples, the kind of overlaying and intercutting of things, which of course can happen in the theater, especially since we live in a day and age when you could combine film and theater.
John, do you think Shakespeare's verse suffers on film or is helped on film, or is there no difference?
Oh, there's a difference. It doesn't always suffer, but it's more likely to suffer on film, assuming you have the same competence and expertise and training and sensitivity amongst the actors. It's going to be 9 times out of 10 more powerful on the stage.
Is that because of the visceral quality of Shakespeare's words, or is it because of just the film medium?
I think it's because there's a subtle audience feedback. An actor knows it, right? If this is not working today, I've got to make an adjustment. So you don't have the feedback. If the film isn't working for a given audience where people aren't familiar with Shakespeare, there is no adjustment in the key. And another part of it is just the sense of, frankly, the voice bouncing off the space and there being a kind of resonance to the live voice, which the plays were written to exploit.
It certainly must be true that any actor performing in a live production of Shakespeare is immediately adapting his performance to suit the specific space and time that he or she is in, and a film simply cannot accommodate that. A film doesn't know whether it's in your living room or whether it's at the Hollywood Bowl.
It does not. You point out that Shakespeare itself is, of course, performed in various different types of spaces, whether it's thrust stages, proscenium stages, indoors, outdoors.
At court.
At court. And there are some people who have written on Shakespeare, or at least one in particular, who looks at film as just really another space. Is it a different media or is it a different venue? In one respect, you can just say that film is a modern venue with particular characteristics. Orson Welles knew that. I mean, he started in radio, and you see his Shakespeare films very, I think, affected by his radio experience.
I can't let you go without talking about various Shakespeare adaptations on films.
Yes.
The most obvious being Kurosawa's Ron and Throne of Blood, but there's plenty of others. 10 Things I Hate About You, Henry Fool, She's the Man, and such and such.
Yes, there's a question. What do you call these things? Right. You call 10 Things I Hate About You a version of Taming of the Shrew, or an adaptation of the Taming of the Shrew? What do you call silent film versions of Shakespeare? If you keep the plot and the characters but bag the language, is it still a version of Shakespeare? If you keep the language but scramble the plot, is it still Shakespeare?
It's not. I was going to go on record and say, it isn't.
But if I say something's a version of Shakespeare, would you disagree with that?
You know, I'm interested in verse speaking and the problems inherent in that, and I'm interested in how verse is edited and amended and modified and altered. But the thing that fascinates me probably least about Shakespeare are the plot.
Yeah, we would never call 10 Things I Hate About You Shakespeare if it were on a stage. But somehow if it's on film, there are a lot lot of people who would use the term. That's a version of shrew. But I guess the answer to your question is I do deal with that. You mentioned Kurosawa, who made basically three films that have something to do with Shakespeare, Ron, Throne of Blood, and The Bad Sleep Well, which is related to Hamlet.
For me, I hold the Kurosawa Shakespeare films, or quote-unquote Shakespeare films, in a completely different place than something like 10 Things I Hate About You or She's the Man.
Is it because of the language that you can't do the verse in the first place, so it gives the filmmaker a more legitimate form of license?
I think that, but because it's one step removed perhaps from our culture, and perhaps because it's one step removed from our present day, not to mention the language removal, I find it more enjoyable. Plus, which, of course, Kurosawa was a genius, and his images are absolutely gorgeous.
There are certain Japanese stories, Japanese story motifs, recorded Japanese historical incidents, which have a certain parallelism to the incidents of Shakespeare's plays. Ron actually combines an actual historical characters, which actually, if you look at the accounts of them, had a lot of similarities to what happens in Lear, for example. So Kurosawa did quite consciously discover overlaps between Shakespeare and not only Japanese story traditions, but Japanese historical events, and play upon those and fuse them artistically.
So, John Osborne, could you describe a film that would delight you?
Let's start here. What's a play that you would like to see done on film, either again or for the first time?
Oh, I think The Romances, are not The Tempest, but Winter's Tale, Cymbeline, Pericles, those things you almost never get to see. I'd certainly like to see some of that on film. I was very glad when Ralph Fiennes, did a Coriolanus on film.
Well, John, this was terrific. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, Garrett.
I'm Garrett Vandermeer.
And I'm Jim Elliott.
And this is The State of Shakespeare.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for joining us for the State of Shakespeare podcast. We invite you to visit stateofshakespeare.com for more episodes, information about each of our guests, and the Shakespeare text you heard on the program, and much more. And we welcome you to join the discussion by liking us on Facebook. That's www.stateofshakespeare.com. Thanks for listening.